When Frantz Fanon lay dying in a Washington hospital in 1961, French authorities were frantically confiscating his newly published masterpiece. They feared his words more than any weapon. Today, The Wretched of the Earth remains a revolutionary touchstone that has influenced movements from the Black Panthers to modern anti-colonial struggles. Nelson Mandela cited it as a primary intellectual influence during his imprisonment. Even hip-hop artists like Dead Prez and Kendrick Lamar reference Fanon's ideas in their lyrics. Why does this work continue to resonate across generations? Because it strips bare the psychological architecture of oppression and offers a radical framework for understanding liberation that transcends its historical moment. The colonial world Fanon describes is fundamentally compartmentalized, divided between the colonizer's realm of wide streets and bright lights versus the colonized world of hunger, disease, and overcrowding. This division isn't merely physical, but psychological, creating wounds that persist for generations. The colonizer systematically fabricates the colonized subject through economic exploitation, cultural degradation, and physical violence, creating a self-perpetuating cycle where oppression is justified by pointing to the very conditions they created. What happens when this cycle is finally broken? What emerges from the wreckage of colonial identity? Decolonization cannot occur peacefully. The colonized, conditioned by settler brutality and police oppression, inhabit a restricted world that demands complete opposition. After seeing peaceful protests met with bullets, they recognize liberation requires force. Nationalist gatherings carry blood in the air, tension from accumulated grievances. The colonized learn that force is the only effective language, creating a pendulum ocean of terror and counter-terror, though colonizers' military might vastly outmatches the colonized. Events like the 12,000 victims of Philippeville, 1955, established devastating points of no return. Paradoxically, violence takes on positive dimensions in liberation struggles. It constitutes meaningful work, mobilizes people collectively, and unifies by eliminating traditional divisions while fostering national consciousness. It acts as a cleansing force that removes the inferiority complex. This explains why many liberation movements, despite peaceful beginnings, eventually embrace armed struggle. Violence becomes both political necessity and psychological liberation. Imagine a revolutionary movement where leaders speak a different language, literally and figuratively, than those they claim to represent. This disconnect between nationalist elites and rural masses forms a tragic dimension of anti-colonial struggles. Nationalist parties mistakenly focus on urban proletarians who comprise barely 1% of the population, while viewing rural populations with the same contempt as colonizers. The young colonized business class clashes with feudal authorities, while traditional leaders feel threatened by urban elites. Colonial powers exploit this division by mobilizing interior populations against coastal ones and reviving tribal identities. When rural populations spontaneously rise up, as in the 1947 Madagascar insurrection, nationalist parties fail to capitalize, neither organizing rebellions nor politicizing the masses. This criminal distrust toward the interior persists even when rural populations are most receptive to political education. The lesson is clear: no revolution succeeds without bridging this divide. Liberation struggles initially erupt with raw, uncoordinated energy. Villages enter a collective ecstasy where feuds dissolve, tribal hatreds disappear, and communities transform into brotherhood-like units sharing resources with remarkable determination. This euphoria proves inadequate against organized counteroffensives. In Angola's 1961 uprising, thousands of poorly armed revolutionaries fell to Portuguese machine guns. Modern warfare demands sophisticated guerrilla tactics, mobile fighting without fixed positions. Leadership soon recognizes military units need both weapons and political enlightenment. The spontaneous peasant revolt must evolve into a coordinated revolutionary war with clear objectives. Meanwhile, colonial powers adapt by combining repression with calculated détente, implementing divisive maneuvers, and exploiting tribal conflicts. Political education becomes necessary. The colonized population remains vulnerable if they believe they can transition directly from subject to sovereign citizen without intermediate steps. Many revolutions fail not from lack of courage, but from inadequate organization and strategic clarity. When the colonizer departs, what remains is often a fragile shell rather than fulfilled aspirations. The national bourgeoisie that inherits power is fundamentally underdeveloped. Its economic power negligible compared to the metropolitan counterpart it seeks to replace. This small class of traders, landowners, and professionals lacks industrialists or financiers and develops a businessman's mentality rather than that of industrial leaders. Instead of serving revolutionary interests, this class embraces conventional bourgeois values, becoming an instrument of neocolonialism. Their calls for nationalization merely transfer colonial privileges to themselves. They function as conveyor belts for capitalism, serving as Western agents while displaying none of the dynamic qualities of a true bourgeoisie. This class transforms the country into a playground for Western tourists, establishing resorts and casinos as a national industry, essentially turning the nation into what Fanon bluntly calls a bordello for Europe. National landowners who acquire former colonial farms intensify worker exploitation without diversifying production. The post-independence bourgeoisie seizes positions previously held by foreigners, promoting nationalization often with racist undertones. How familiar this sounds today, where political independence has frequently failed to deliver economic sovereignty. The faces at the top change, while the structures of exploitation remain intact. The colonized intellectual faces an excruciating dilemma. Educated in Western institutions, they later feel compelled to reject these accomplishments as instruments of alienation. When reconnecting with indigenous heritage, they confront what colonial education labeled mindlessness and savagery. Some claim dual identities, speaking as an Algerian and a Frenchman, while others seek universal perspectives or immerse themselves in Western culture for legitimacy. The colonized writer typically evolves through three phases: European assimilation, disturbed reconnection with their people, and finally, the combat stage as revolutionary galvanizers. Yet paradoxically, they often continue using the colonizers' techniques while expressing national authenticity. True cultural authenticity isn't found in fossilized traditions, but in evolution. Artists fixating on supposedly authentic cultural elements produce lifeless work. As Haitian poet René Depestre suggests, genuine culture demands a dynamic process of concession, of oneself to others, of present to future. The revolutionary must join people in their living present, not retreat into a static past. Colonialism generates psychiatric disorders, decaying both land and mind. Liberation wars create mental wounds, while colonial domination negates the colonized's humanity, forcing constant identity questioning. Fanon documents revealing cases: a taxi driver with migraines after his wife's rape by soldiers, a massacre survivor developing psychosis, a fighter hallucinating after killing, police officers haunted by torture they conducted. Colonial war produces numerous psychosomatic disorders: ulcers, renal colic, menstrual disturbances, hypersomnia, premature white hair, panic attacks, and muscular contraction. Patients describing themselves as stiff as a corpse, physically embodying psychological resistance. Fanon calls to break with Europe, which never stops talking of man, yet massacres him at every one of its street corners. The Third World must forge its own path rather than catch up with Europe. Humanity must create a new history, acknowledging both Europe's achievements and crimes. Our task is clear: create a new humanity through revolutionary struggle. This new humanity defines a new humanism through its objectives and methods. We must make a new start, develop new thinking, and create a new person.